is really XSLT in a nutshell. I have to warn you that XSLT is pretty much a full programming language, and teaching it in half a day is really ambitious. I really wanted a full day, but obviously they're not at Chipotle with what they wanted to give. So I'm going to, you know, you'll get an overview. You'll kind of understand the basic model of the language. And during the breaks and other sessions, I can answer questions in detail. You know, if you want to know how to do some particular problem. I do want to take questions as we go along, though, also, if you have something that relates specifically to the slides, so that we can, so that, because other people in the crowd will probably have the same questions if there's something that's not clear in the slides from that. So, my name is Paul Fleshgod, consultant that, I work a lot with XML technologies. I'm now getting into web services thing. I've been in Python for a little while. That's kind of my relation to the O'Reilly universe. And XSLT is a language that I've used heavily for different types of transformations and style and type projects. So, what is XSLT? We'll go through this pretty quickly, probably. You wouldn't be here if you didn't have some sense of what it is or how it might be useful. And maybe you just noticed the X in the name because you need to collect your list of XML technologies. So, XSLT is a language for transforming XML. It stands for XSL, XML style language transformation. It's kind of a funny name, but it's for taking XML and in some way renaming elements, moving elements, changing the content, and so forth. All sorts of different transformations. So if you think of an XML document as a tree of elements, then it's about getting from one tree to another. The changes could be major or minor. It could be, you know, you could just add an attribute to everything, or they could be complete reorganization of all of the content. Okay. So examples of common transformations are you transform from a structured, highly structured vocabulary like DocBook to something that's just designed for the presentation, more like HTML for the web. If you have vocabularies that are very similar, you just need to change a few element names, rename a few element types, you can do that. Or even within the same vocabulary, if you just wanted to add an attribute to every element or remove an attribute from every element. I'm hoping that everybody here has a rough grasp on XML because I don't have time to go into the detail on that. So these are a common use case, batch formatting, to be able to just go in XSLT and a bunch of XML documents to get out something like HTML or this XSL formatting options that we'll talk about in a second on the other side. Also, nowadays it's possible to directly browse XML files on the internet, on the web, and do the transformation on the client side. This is still quite real on real sites, primarily because you can't know whether the client person's using supports this yet. You know, too many people still run old versions of Netscape or even browsers that are, you know, may never support XSLT like Lynx or something like that. So most people do the conversions on the server side as opposed to the client side. But it is possible, you know, if you know what browsers your clients are going to use, if you're willing to constrain yourself, then you can do it on the client side, and that will offload some of the processing, of course. Inter-vocabulary translation. So I distinguish this from the formatting-type translations, where you're working with more of maybe an e-business or some kind of, you know, data-oriented XML, not designed for presentation to a human being. So you might want to transform from a proprietary vocabulary used within your organization to a public one or vice versa. Okay. And the last little category I talk about is merging data, where you just want to add an element, remove an element, add an attribute, remove an attribute, and so forth. This is quite very similar to the one before, so about dumbing down data from a structured format to a presentation-oriented format. One of the strengths of XSLT is that it allows you to reuse the same content in multiple ways. And this is one of the things that, as you're achieving XSLT Zen, you'll want to get a handle on. What differentiates between a more kind of simple style language like CSS and XSLT is to a large extent, the ability to use the same content, even after a transformation. You know, you can use in an encyclopedia, the title of the article could be in the page that represents the article itself, right? In the header, so the HTML header for that. If there's a photo, the portion page will know what they're looking at. If there's a table of contents for the website, you want it to be in there. If there's a listing by author, then maybe you would say this author, this title, and so forth. So it's fairly common to use the same information twice. And XSLT makes that relatively easy. Here's an example, so just to give you an idea of what a transformation looks like. Example input document. Okay? So it's similar to an automobile or something like that. It has dates. Every payload has a date, a location, and a reason. A reason that the payload occurred. And here's an example of output. So this is something, this is like an HTML-like language. It's not exactly HTML. I wanted to stress that you can output to anything, although HTML is really common. So I chose something similar to HTML. So we have rows and cells, and HTML will be called rows and TDs and so forth. Okay? This is the output of the same data. So what have we done? We added a heading row, a headings row. We switched the location and date around. We renamed a bunch of elements. Let's go back, show that. So date used to precede location, but in the output, I've decided for stylistic reason that maybe the location should precede the date. So the location is the first heading and the date is the second one. I've added this whole headings section. So I've added in boilerplate content into my document. And all of these things that used to have really specific names, location, date, and so forth, became just cell. So I've sort of dumbed down the data, taken a very specific, domain-specific element and made it into a generic presentation-oriented element. Now let's talk about how we would actually do this transformation. So an XSLT style sheet consists of a bunch of rules, template rules as they're called. So it's a rule-driven process. And every template rule consists of a pattern that says, if you see this, when you see this, do this. And that's a transformation, the thing that you do. So it's a really common pattern in computer science, this idea of a pattern matrix. And the action in XSLT is a template which says, what to output, what the output should look like. Every input element is matched to one of the rules in the document and processed with that rule. Okay? That terminology is not 100% strict because later on you could actually process that thing again with a different rule if you wanted to. But every time you see an element, it sees an element, it's going to look up a single rule, you know, it's kind of the primary rule that processes. And that rule is found based on the pattern. So it says, okay, you were looking for cells, there's a rule that matches cells, I'll process with cells. So, and then the rule applies the template. So in programming language terms, a template rule is roughly like a function in that it's a little bit of encapsulated code. But whereas in a programming language, you almost always say, go specifically to this function, you know, call this function. In XSLT, it's a kind of a negotiation between the style sheet and the document. The style sheet says, oh, what rules do I have for this element? And it puts the two together. It finds a rule and puts it with the element. And then output, we create what are so-called result elements. So the result is a result element. And they can conform to any vocabulary whatsoever, HTML, formatting objects, Java, it doesn't matter, any vocabulary you want. So here are some examples. If you use the HTML namespace for your result elements, then you'll get HTML out, and it could be displayed by a legacy browser. There's this thing called a formatting objects, which is more print-only, it's more useful print, although it was originally intended to be a static replacement HTML for XML on the web. And any other vocabulary is also new. Okay. So, because this is an important output plugin, I want to just summarize the relationship between XSLT and HTML. It is possible for XSLT to generate HTML, and not just XHTML, not just the newer XML variant of HTML, but actually the old HTML that will be understood by ancient browsers. If you ask it to generate HTML, it will generate old-fashioned HTML, not XHTML.
Is that then non-fuzzable HTML?
No, it was because StyleSheet itself is supposed to be well formed, the output will always be well formed. It forces that naturally. But things like end tags will be in the old style instead of the new style. Okay. Formatting objects. If you're interested in doing print, then the formatting objects part of the XSLT, of the XSL specification is probably of interest to you. Because there are no browsers that accept formatting objects, it's probably not useful on the web right now. But I know there are no browsers that accept formatting objects. There is a tool called FOP, which can convert them into PDF for printing. I guess you could put a PDF on the web, but it's kind of perverse. So, what is XPath? XPath is a subset, is a sort of component of XSLT. It's part of what you need to understand to use XSLT. It's a simple query and addressing language for XML. Relatively simple, maybe. Actually, I could do a full half day on XPath alone, so I guess I shouldn't say it's really simple, but the basic concepts are pretty simple. And we can use XPath to query for single elements, node sets, and, any kind of combination of elements in the document. XPath is actually popular in some contexts outside of XSLT, although it was mostly designed for XSLT. It's also used in a schema language called Schematron, and there are lots of different little specifications that are embedded in there. So why do we care about XPath? Well, before you can work on any data, you need to be able to actually find it, right? So, and there are a variety of ways to find information. In a document. You could find it by name, so if you're looking for a particular element with a certain element type and so forth, you can find it by position, so you can say I'm looking for the fifth element of this element type, or the tenth element in the document, and by relationship to some other component. So you can say, find me this element, and find me its fifth child that is of this type. So XPath allows us to do all these sorts of things. So here's a basic, very basic XPath, kind of the smallest XPath that's really useful. And what this will do is return the root element of a document, the so-called document element, if and only if it is of type doc. Okay, so this is called XPath because it's designed to look like a path. In a lot of ways, the semantics are very different than operating system paths, but it does look like a path. So, it says find me the doc element. Now this returns the title element within the doc element. This is presuming, let's say, that there's only one title within the doc. So in that case, it is like a path. You're looking for a doc, you go into that doc element, and then you go into a title sub-element. And then it returns me that title sub-element. And here's almost the same, this is exactly the same syntactically, but it's a little bit different in the way you think about it. If we had sections, obviously we would expect to have zero or more sections, or one or more sections. So in this case, the same XPath is returning now, same XPath is returning multiple things. So you should think of an XPath as being like a query when there are more than one thing. So it can be thought of as a path if there's only one thing that you know will be there. In this case, we'll return all the sections within the doc. We can go down as many levels as we want. So this will return all titles within all sections within the doc element. And of course, because XML requires you to have a single root element, there will only be one doc element. We can also put wildcards in. So this says that I'm looking for all title elements within any kind of element within a doc. The wildcard only represents one level though. We'll go into cases where it might represent multiple, where you might want to represent multiple levels later. But this is saying that I'm looking for a particular title within anything or within a doc. Okay, all the titles get grandchildren of the doc element. If we wanted to allow a search to go as deep as possible in the XML tree, then we can do that. So this will return all the section must be directly within the doc, and the doc must be directly at the root. Yeah, that's what the leading slash means, directly at the root. The second slash means directly within doc. But then the double slash syntax means anywhere below me. Okay, anywhere below me. So anywhere below this section, it will find all titles. So another way of saying this is to return all title nodes that are anywhere in the document inside of all section elements, anywhere within, sorry, within the directly within the root doc element. So that's what the first one does. The second one uses double slashes in two different places, so the sections can also be as deep as possible, as necessary. You could even have a section within a section. It would select both the parent select section and the child section. So that brings us to an important kind of mental model note, which is that this is not returning text. It's returning these logical constructs of nodes. In the same way that a query into a relational database returns you this logical construct of a record, these are like objects. They are called nodes. An element is a particular kind of node, but there are also text nodes for text things, an attribute node, that is so forth. And we call these descendant Okay, so in this case, I'm getting all of the text nodes within, directly within the title element, directly within the doc element. So it's essentially the text nodes representing the title of the document. Again, the nodes, not the string text. There are ways of getting back the string text, but what we'll get back in a logical sense is the node. We can also get comments. This will get me all the comments in the document, no matter how deep they are. Okay. And this will get me processing instructions that are directly within the doc element. Okay.
Defined in XSLT, and there's a finite number of things.
Like there's a finite number of node types, and they're actually defined in XPath. So XPath is a separate specification from XSLT that XSLT points to.
Right.
But you can go to the website. There's, I think the only other one, there may be a couple of minor ones that I missed, like the document for the whole document, maybe one or two other minor ones that I missed. Dot dot represents the parent node. This is again a little bit more like file systems. So in this case, I'm finding all footnotes anywhere within the document, and then I'm using dot dot to find out what element it's within. And the important thing to recognize is that this does not return footnote elements. It returns elements that contain footnote elements. You know what I'm saying? Because it's the thing at the farthest right, it's the last thing that says what is returned, not, you know, whichever is kind of the most visible footnote and uppercase, you know, that's sort of what your mind latches onto, but it's the rightmost thing that's the most important. So this will return the title elements of current elements of footnote elements anywhere in the document. That makes sense? Okay, so on to attributes. We just put the little at symbol before the name to represent an attribute. So at foo means the attribute named foo. Okay? Of course, you should not expect to see the little attribute sign in your XML documents. This is only an XPath thing to select the attributes. So this will select the security attribute of the section element. And again, it returns me an object, a structured object, which is both the name and the value of the attribute, not just the value. So I could ask, in this case it wouldn't make sense to ask that node what its name is because I know in advance, but sometimes you could select all the attributes of an element and then ask them their names, and maybe you want to print them out, or maybe you want to filter based on the first three characters of their names. You can do kind of crazy stuff like that. This will get me all security attributes in the document. So I'm using a wildcard. They say I don't care what element type I'm dealing with. But just find me a security attribute on that element. And once again, I'm not returning the element, I'm returning the attribute object, the attribute node. I'm returning the attribute node, not the element that contains that attribute. If I wanted to add element, I could say slash dot dot. I had to think of at least one question.
Yes, why did you have to specify the wildcard there?
Actually, I'm not sure I had to.
Or double slash means the same thing.
Yeah. Let me just think for 1 second whether it would have mattered if I just done slash slash out security.
Does the wild card match no levels? Because otherwise that would mean it has to be one level down from
the wild card. Right. Well, no, it's when the child, when the slash precedes an attribute, if you're asking for an attribute, then it doesn't go down another level looking for it. So it goes into the attribute. It's a little bit confusing in that way, but that's part of why I did it this way. But so for instance, in this example, I'm not looking for a child of section with a security attribute. I'm looking for the security attribute of the section.
So that attribute is treated like child mode.
Only when there's an at sign. Yeah. Let me say why I'm uncomfortable to say that.
A node.
If you,
a node can have attributes. A child.
Right. An element node can have attributes. If you. There are some corner cases here that I should.
You might be able to talk about those actors.
Yeah, I was hoping to put that off, but underlying all of this, there's a concept of an axis, which is a direction of looking for something. So dot dot means to look up into my parent axis, and there's the attribute axis and the child axis and so forth. And so looking at the security does take us into the attribute axis. So that's why they're not strictly speaking a child, not a child node, because there is this concept of a child axis. But essentially they try to make the syntax so it looks like a child, even though kind of deep down in the internals there will be cases where it's not really a child. That's kind of the best I can do in the time of illness, unfortunately. But did anyone have any other questions about that?
Did you answer the original question yet?
Okay, so yeah. I think that because of the little syntactic tricks that they use, I could have just put at security at the top level, and it would have looked not only down descendants, but into the attribute axis for those things, and still found the attribute value. This is semantically equivalent. I think it's a little bit clearer that it's looking for an element and then looking for an attribute on the element. Okay. So XPaths are evaluated in a context. I've been saying do a search for in the current document. So there's always a notion of the current document that we're working with. And in fact, there's usually a context of the current node, the current element that we're kind of interested in. All of the XPaths I've given so far are completely absolute. So it's just like in directory paths. If you're down 6 levels and you give an absolute path, it doesn't matter that you're down 6 levels in 5 or 4. So I haven't had to talk about node context. But in there is a concept of a current node, just as there is in directories. And just like in directories, the current node or the context node is specified with the dot. The dot means the current node. So if we point inside the XPath dot slash P, it means start at the current node and find me the P element that's the P elements, if there's more than one, that are children of that node. Okay. And the XPath dot slash asterisk will find all elements that are children of this current element. So this can be a little bit of a subtle concept sometimes. So in the context of doc, if I say dot slash section, or if I use an abbreviated form, just section, so just like in a file system, I can get rid of the leading dot slash and let it be implicit. Okay. This will return a single node. So dot slash section, when the current node is docked, returns a single section. The two elements within don't count because they're not directly within the context node, the current node, which I've specified as docked. If the top level section happened to be the context node, then it would select the other two. Does that make sense? So sometimes people have a feeling that when I do this, it's going to be some kind of floating search through the whole document, but it's not. It's rooted right now. It's rooted at the whatever the current node is. And again, we will put this in an XSLT context so you'll understand when I'm in this rule, you know, what's the current node.
You can do slash.
Yep. So you can put a dot in front of anything. And in fact, I think almost always you can just leave off the dot and just. Well, see, that's an example of you can't. Now that you mentioned. So, he asked about whether you could do dot slash slash section. And I said, yes, you could use that to search all the way down for a section. But if you leave off the leading dot, then it'll get confused and think you meant to go to the loop. Because slash slash section means go to the loop. Because anything that starts with slash means go to the loop. So that's one case where you really do need the dot. Okay. So, any system that embeds XPath, including XSLT or any XSLT processor, can add functions that are specific to their needs. So most XSLT implementations add specific functions, and XSLT itself, as a standard, adds features to raw XPath, you know, to the base XPath features. And I have an appendix in your printed notes on some kind of advanced Okay, so now we're going to try to put this into an XSLT context so that you can see how to use XPath within XSLT. So to kind of recap what we started with, the input to an XSLT process is some kind of transformation or template and the source document. Okay, so I say transformation or template because you can have an XSLT process, an XSLT style sheet that consists of only one template. Right? But usually you'll have many and we call it a transformation. So you put in these two things. What do I want to do with the data? And here's the data. And then the output is some kind of XML tree or text file. So, there were two different kind of models for using XSLT. You kind of a more simple model and a more sophisticated one. The simple model is a template document where the whole thing consists of one single template. But most transformations are more sophisticated than that and consist of many templates. Let's say on average one template per element type in your document. Sometimes you'll have two templates for a particular element type depending on the context of the element, or sometimes you will handle two elements in a single rule. You can do both of those things, but roughly you use, you know, one element, one template rule per element. So the templates pull information out of the document, format it or wrap it in other elements and other text nodes and so forth, and then output it. And the transformation, the full transformation, goes back and forth between the templates, which say what to do, and the document, which says, you know, here's the data, and it goes back and forth between those two kind of inputs. So here's an example of an input document, simple input document, and there's a standard for associating XSLT style sheets with documents. I believe it's supported in both IE and Mozilla. So you type in that, and then you have a book element. Okay, and it has a title and a logo and a description and so forth. And again, this declaration has to come after the XML declaration, if there is an XML declaration. Okay, so it pulls in some template document. Here's my template document. I've designed this template document as a single template, okay? So the only clue that this is actually XSLT is this XML namespace and the XSL colon version element or attribute on that HTML element. So it looks like an HTML document because it's just it's like a PHP template or an ASP template, whatever templating language you're used to. It's similar to that, except you just give it this hint that you're going to be using XSLT primitives with the namespace and the XSL colon colon. And then you have some elements, etc. So it's all just standard boilerplate elements. Here's the title of the book. It's all boilerplate text. And then I do a value of, so this is an XSLT instruction that we'll talk more about later on. And it selects a title from the book. And it will just place that in the template at that position for viewing in the browser. And here we have an image. And again, I'm using an XSLT feature to pull in a URL from the book document. Go back to the book. There's a URL on the logo.
In the previous slide, you had text in lowercase and both of those brackets as a function to return the text note. What's the difference between that and what you're using?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. So, XSLT is a very loosely typed language. So, when you hand it a node and tell it, give me the value of this node, so this query is for a node, and when you tell it to give me the value of that node, it will try to, in some way, coerce it into a certain value. So in this case, the coercion it would use is, for elements, the coercion it uses is to find all the text nodes and convert them to strings. So you could explicitly put slash text there. Where you would explicitly use slash text is if you wanted to work with the thing as a node, maybe pass it to another template or something like that. But if you only want the value, then you can leave off that slash text.
Does its version of XPath that it uses, does it honor all the other kinds of functions?
Yes. So the XSLT version of XPath is a strict superset of what's in the XPath specification. If we have time, I'll go even deeper into the XPath specification and lots of mathematical operators and functions and stuff that we can talk about. So I'll talk about these cognitive races for a second. Those are just your way of saying that this is something to be computed. So if you put cognitive races in an attribute value like that, then it will instead of just outputting this actual, you know, slash book slash element as literal text, it will know that even though the element is on as an image element, you know, not anything in the XSLT namespace, you want it to compute that as an XSLT instruction.
I've got a question on that. I'm just going to follow up to his question.
Sure.
Is it treated like as a default node type, or just kind of as a string, or?
Yeah. So what it will do is it will find that title element, and then it'll say, "Oh, someone's asking me for the text of that." Okay. So all XPath does is return the title element. Okay. But then the XSLT engine, which kind of wraps the XPath, says, "Now can you give me the value of that thing?" And the value of an element is defined to be all of the text within it. The value of an attribute is defined to be the attribute value, right? Its name, but its value, right?
Okay, because I'm going back to the you said earlier, find a number of node types. So the default, in the absence of specifying a certain one, it's going to give you the text.
That's true. Okay.
And the template document must be well formed.
Yes. But there's an important distinction I should make here. The input template document must be well formed, but the output, as I said before, will actually be old-fashioned HTML. So there's a heuristic it uses. If the root element is HTML or the namespace is HTML, there's a heuristic it uses to know that you're trying to output HTML. For other purposes, you can just use the HTML root element. That will tell it that you want HTML as an output. And it will then do things like use the HTML style end tags instead of the XML style end tags. And so people often want to put in HTML style as the input. You can't do that. Both of the inputs to an XSLT engine, both the document input and the XSLT template have to be well formed, but the output will not necessarily be well formed from an XML point of view.
What if you wanted the text of child elements as well?
Actually, it does that by default.
It goes
all the way down looking for all of the text. If you ask for the value of slash, which is the root node, you get the text of the document with no elements or anything. Not attributes. Attributes are not included in that. That's again, that's another one of these reasons why attributes are not really children in the same sense.
So what if you wanted just the text of that node, not?
Okay. See, that's where you would use slash text with parentheses, because then it would not recurse. If you wanted it to recurse, then you would use slash slash text. I said before that it's the same as slash text because I was thinking of title being, you know, an element that has only text as a child. But if titles were allowed within titles were allowed within titles, then you might want to explicitly say slash text to say only the text nodes directly within the title. Does that make sense? So only the text within that title, not the text within children of that or children of children of that. Okay, so this is the XSL namespace. The XSL was standardized in 1999. XSLT was standardized in 1999, so it's got that namespace. Older versions of Internet Explorer, if you happen to need compatibility with them, they use this older, strange XSLT namespace. Nowadays, really, you should only use this one. I should also point out, if anyone's using older versions of Internet Explorer, there are lots of subtle differences from the real XSLT language, so it'll be somewhat of a headache. Yeah. not only did they implement what was the working graph at the time, but they had some of their own ideas of how they could improve the working graph. We use zero-based indexing instead of one-based indexing. That makes a little bit more sense.
Are you going to talk more about the Netscape 6 support? I don't know anything about it, but I've seen that in other places, the Netscape 6.
Yeah, I think that the syntax that's in the notes just do the XML dash style sheet. We'll pull in an XSLT style sheet and we'll work. You can do a Google search to find out if the bugs or features that they don't implement, but as far as I know, most of the standard stuff just works. I'm not 100% clear on Mozilla. Netscape for sure, they document they support it. I'm not sure whether the default builds of Mozilla, maybe someone else in the cloud knows, the kind of the raw Mozilla builds, whether they, I know that the Mozilla code base has the features, whether they turn it on by default or not, I'm not sure. So that's something we could pretty easily check, maybe during the build. Okay. So, let's talk a little bit more about templates. We're going to get into full transformation. I can understand templates kind of as a basis. So, what do templates do, like this one that we just were looking at? Well, first, any element that's not in the XSLT namespace is kind of more or less blindly output sent to the output. So, an HTML element will be sent as HTML. Obviously, the special attributes, the XSL version ones, will be taken out, but HTML will be sent, head will be sent, title will be sent, a document will be sent. All that will be just output as is. Okay. So all the text in the style sheet is output. All the text in the template is output as is also. The things that are processed are in XSLT instructions, things that start with the XSL colon. Okay, and so we'll go through a list of those. There are many different XSLT instructions. Value of is just the first one that we'll discuss. And anything in attributes that's in curly braces is also processed. So if you have an attribute on one of these literal result elements, like image, I have an image element and I put in curly braces, slash logo at URL, that gets processed. As opposed to just output. Does that clear to each other? Is that everybody? So, unlike in a programming language where by default you have, traditional programming languages where by default you have code and then you put quotes around values, XSLT assumes kind of in template context anyhow that you want something output as a value unless you specifically say, hey, this is for you, the processor, the XSLT processor. So that's one reason why XSLT would be more convenient for working with XML than a traditional programming language. For the same reason that PHP is easier for working with HTML than a traditional programming language. Okay. So the first instruction that we'll discuss is the value of instruction. And the value of outputs some kind of computed value. So it will just calculate a value. As a string, so of course the output always has to be some kind of a string. It's really the only XML in the standard data type. There's a select attribute on the value of, which figures out which thing to take the value of, right? And sorry, I have a typo there. It should be select, obviously. So this will get the value of the title. This is the title. So yeah, so this is something that we touched on a little bit before. So the value of a text node is its character data, just the text of the text node. The value of the element is an element is the character data of all of the text nodes directly contained or contained by descendants of that element. Okay, so that's what we discussed before. If you had a title within a title for some reason, you would get the contents of both of them. If you ask only for the value of the element. If you want specifically the text nodes only directly within the element, then you should ask for them with the slash text. And the value of an attribute is the filter data in its value. So the value of an attribute is its value. Sounds obvious, but really an attribute is an object that has a name and a value. But when you convert it to a value, it goes away the name part. Okay. So Let's talk now about full transformation. So not just one template document, but this full control flow going back and forth between the style sheet and the documents, multiple templates and so forth. What we have is a style sheet, is an XSL colon style sheet element. We'll see that in a second. And we have instructions at the top level of that style sheet. Things like templates that affect the whole, that will affect the whole process. There are rules like for how to output numbers and rules for what kind of end tags to use for the output. There's all kinds of different things you can put at the top level. We'll discuss some of them during this talk. Within templates, there are other things you can do. So you can do direct recursive template application. We'll talk about that in more detail. We'll do the value of, we've talked about, and so forth. So again, if you go back to a programming language analogy, if templates are like functions, obviously there are certain statements in most programming languages that can go within functions, and then there are certain statements that can only go at the level, right? So the XSLT has the same distinction. Notice that Python doesn't have that distinction. Some languages do. XSLT is like the languages that do. So, templates, the XSL colon template is one of the most important elements in a transformation, in that it, as I said a couple times, it's like the functions in this language. And they contain the code for what is the output from a transformation. So, as I said before, it has a pattern that says, for instance, when you see example elements, do this. Make a horizontal line, I'll put the text example, I'll put an example number, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are as many instructions as you want. The match attribute on the template rule is what actually chooses which nodes it applies to. And the match attribute is another type of XPath, another way that XSLT uses XPath. So, and within the template, we'll have things like literal result elements, literal text, and more instructions. So here's an example of a template that matches an element called example. Now the way that XPaths are used in template rules is a little bit different than the way that they're used in select attributes. In the sense that a template rule has, a select attribute is saying, here I am in a context, find me a node that matches, right? So it's a find operation. In the match context, it's saying, if this element matches this XPath, then apply this template rule. So the formal way to say this is there exists an element in the document such that this element, the current element that I'm trying to match to a rule, would be in the result set for that. That's applied to that element, then this rule matches. So to say that again, this is in another way. Because say I'm trying to match an example element. Okay, because there exists a parent of the element, whatever the parent is the example, such that the current element is in its list of examples, it does match, that element does match this thing. That will maybe become a little bit more clear as we go into more complicated, match attributes.
This might be a trivia question, but just curious. Are these comments carried through to the output, or are they consumed by the XSLT processor?
No, comments are consumed by the processor. If you really want to put a comment in the output, you can say XSL colon comment. So moving on from the match attribute, we have a horizontal rule element. And then I have a comment that's only for use by people looking at the style sheet. I have an example. Then I have an XSL number. So XSL number is just one of those XSL statements that are available. I have a pre element, which is an HTML standard pre-formatted text. And then I have another XSL instruction called apply templates that we'll talk about. So I just want to show you the mixing and matching of literal results, elements, literal text, and XSL instructions. Okay, I'll start with this question.
The XSL number element, what's that?
Are
we going to go into that?
I don't know if we'll have time to go into it in detail, but it does numbering. So like the first section or the second section or the third section or the first footnote or the second footnote or the third footnote. In this case, it would figure out which example number it is within the chapter. Okay, yeah, I'll go to this question.
Yeah, you can close your paragraph there.
Did I miss a tag? Oh yeah, that's right, yeah. It should be well formed, so I would need to put an end paragraph tag probably. Any other questions?
Can you use XMLP to output non-well formed?
Yeah, as the root element that's output, then it will know that you want it to output non well formed data, and it will just do that for you. It will just do it automatically. So even though the input is well formed, the output will not be. It won't look exactly the same. You have to think of the input not as being kind of raw text that's output, but it's interpreted. Even the elements and raw text are kind of interpreted by the XSLT process.
Another question? Well, if you had some markup that the XSLT processor didn't know anything about that you were producing, it just so happens it completely invalid XML, but it had lots of angle brackets. Would that be messy? Would that be very difficult to do?
Yeah.
Is there any way that you can bury that and see that?
Yeah. So you could. So there's the XSLT features, the XML features for escaping things like less than signs. So you could either use ampersand, LT semicolon, or C data. But the problem is...
I think you can use the XSL output.
Right, specify
your outputting text.
Right, that's what I was about to get to, but of course I have to explain why you need that. So the problem is, yes, you can easily get the less than sign into the XSLT processor by using the ampersand, LT semicolon, or C data section or whatever, but it will on output try to escape it as XML too, right? Because it will presume that you want your output to be well formed. Okay. But there is a feature called XSL colon output, where you can tell it that you specifically want non well formed output, and then it will, allow things like less than versus less than. Okay. So rules are applied recursively in the sense that usually you start with the very top rule for the whole document, and then it explicitly will ask for the handling of certain elements, and those will be handled by other rules, and then they will be have some elements and they will be handled by other rules, and so on and so forth down the document. So typically the processing goes in the order of the elements in your document. You're not required to do that, but it's a way, it's a mental model, because that's usually how you do it. And it's special XSL colon apply templates instruction that actually says within one rule, for the root element, let's say, that, hey, I really want you now to process all of my children with whatever rule is appropriate for them. And you can even call that thing twice and process your children twice. Or you could not call it at all and ignore your children. No child abuse in that. So which rule to apply? Whenever it sees an element in an whenever you call XSL apply template, it looks at all the children elements and it says, now what rule do I apply to these things? There are a whole bunch of rules, and each rule knows how to handle some particular certain other elements, but not other certain other elements. And each rule has a pattern match attribute, and the pattern's syntax is a subset of XPath. The subset, essentially everything we've taught actually is within that subset. So here's an example document. I have a doc element, it has a section, it has two sections. Each section has a title and a paragraph. Okay, so this is the input data that we're going to be working with. give you a second to get a feeling for that. And here's an example of a style sheet. It's got a template. We're matching the doc element. So we're matching the loot element of the document flows. We make outputting some HTML elements, body, and then in the middle I'm saying, now that I'm in the body, apply templates for my children. So now I'm in the body, please handle all of my children elements, which in this case are the sections.
Is it significant that there's no slash dot from the match?
In this case, it would be the same because there's only one doc element and it's the loot element. But if a doc could contain a doc, could contain a doc, then this rule would match all of them. Whereas if you put a slash in front, you'd be saying explicitly that only the loot one would match. Does that make sense? So you can make a rule absolute if you want to handle second level sections. So sections within doc, you can make a rule that's that kind of hard coded. Or you can make a rule that's floating that says any section within another section is fine. Default, most often we will make floating types of rules because we don't want to overly, you know, when you find a footnote, you usually don't know how many levels deep in the document is going to be, whether it's directly within a paragraph or whether it's within a footnote or in a section and so forth. You usually want these kind of floating type rules, but sometimes you do want a really fixed rule, you know, you want to handle the titles of the top level sections different than the titles of second level sections, then you want a very precise rule, so you struggle to slash to say only if this many levels deep do I apply that. Okay? Okay, so here's a template rule for a section. And what I'm gonna do is output an HTML div and that's all. Then again, I'll just apply templates for my children. Maybe I would, I could do more complicated stuff. I could do a table or something like that. But keep it simple. I'm just gonna output div elements and continue with my children.
To complicate this a little bit.
Sure.
Would it be relatively simple to add a class ID to the div tag just by using that?
Yes. That's probably even a better example. Probably should. You just put an attribute there and put whatever you want in it. You can write in the development, you can say class equals food. That's what you think. And it would just output that as a, or I could have put a horizontal rule before it could separate it from the section before. So here's a little bit more complicated example. Now I'm looking for a title within a section. Okay, so this is again, how match attributes differ from select attributes. I'm looking for any title that matches the section will match this rule. So I will be comparing, as it goes through, it will compare title elements against this rule. This would be really important if I had also a doc title. So there's a title element in the doc and a title element in a section, and I need to process them differently, then I would need a rule like this that's more specific than just an element type. And we can, using techniques that we'll get into later, we can also, based on attribute values, you know, an element with this attribute value, or an element with this child element. So what are we doing in this template? I'll put an H1 element inside of it, process, other templates. What we're saying is process any child elements of this title. But not just elements, I should say child nodes, because in this case the children will most likely be text nodes. Right? The title, the children of a title is just text. So this will process the text node.
So if that's the case, would this be equivalent to just to say value of?
Yes it is, but for reasons I haven't taught yet. So based on what we've learned so far, what this would do is look for a rule that actually has a matches text input. Okay? But there is a default rule that we'll talk about later that would handle the case where that rule is missing. But if you wanted to handle this in a strict sense, then you would make another rule of text, or even text within title, and so forth. Although I could do value of instead of doing a by. If all I want to do is pull out the text, then I could use value of. But this gives me a little bit more flexibility. I guess I could, in that text rule, I could output another value and then the text. So this could be more, allow something more sophisticated than just outputting the text.
Just to get an idea of how complex SRT could be, I'm wondering whether you could do something like, you've got the H1 type there, and you're matching sections, you might have a section within a section. Could you, with SRT, say, if I were this level down, say to an H2 or an H3 or an H4, for example, could you do that with it?
Yeah. I mean, the simplest way to do it based on basic XSLT features is to have different rules, right? But you know, so based on just what we talked so far, you can do that just with different rules. But if you wanted to be tricky and do some math and glue together the H and the 1, you could do that stuff. You could do that stuff. Using features that most of which you probably won't be able to get to today.
Okay, and when you get to the apply template, I assume it applies all templates. Again, at that point.
All templates to the children of this node. So all child. It looks for the children of this node. The apply templates does.
But it applies all templates that are defined in the.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
To the children of that template.
Exactly. Okay. Well, it applies whichever ones apply. Whichever ones make sense. Match.
Right.
It
will check them all again.
It will check them all again.
Okay. Now, what happens if there's a doc element underneath the section title? Does it go back up to the doc style sheet?
Yep. That's an important point, is that if you have recursive elements like sections within sections or docs within titles for docs and so forth, it will just keep recursing. You don't have to worry about an infinite loop because you're always moving down the XML tree in your input document, right? So you're never going to get caught in an infinite loop. As long as you use these kind of basic features, you won't get caught in an infinite loop. That's maybe another advantage of XSLT over programming language. You have to work a little bit harder to get an infinite loop. And here we have a paragraph element, and then we're just doing the same thing. We're just going to apply all templates with. This is a case where we probably not want to use. Maps usually contain most text. We would probably not want to use value of it because it might just be something like an italicized element or an emphasis element or something. We would want to handle the text and then handle the emphasis element and then handle the other text. This template will do that for us.
The effect of that last template is to strip off the attribute.
Well, again, we haven't talked about the default rules yet, so I'm trying to be explicit to show all the rules, but there is a default rule built in, so some of these rules that I've shown are strictly necessary, because they would correspond to the default rules. So, what if no rules match? So if I left off that last rule for paragraphs, or if I left off any of the other rules, in fact I did leave off a rule for how to handle text nodes, for instance. So there are implicit built-in default rules built into every style sheet. And the rules are called automatically if no other rule matches. And the reason for this is because the kind of processing done by XLT is sort of so there are patterns that are so common that they're built into the languages and default rules. So the built-in default rules say to process sub-elements and output the text of a node. So if you, let's say that you had left out the rule for a paragraph element. Actually, yeah, that input answers the question you just had. If I had left off a rule for a paragraph element, it would only output the text of that element. If I left off a rule for the doc element, which is an element that has elements within it, then it would still know to apply templates and go to its children elements. Okay, so if you forget an element at some level, it doesn't, you know, truncate that part of the tree. It just ignores the tags more or less for that element. Ignores the tags for that element and continues processing. So if I left off that, if I leave off a rule, you know, that element will disappear, but its contents will not disappear. So just before we go, just before I answer your question, if you do that at the very root, if you left the whole thing blank, if you left the style sheet completely blank, then when you combine those two rules, what you end up with is the text of the document. Because every element is looked at, and then its tags are thrown away, and then it goes down until it finds text, and then it outputs the text. So that's kind of the default XSLT style sheet is just output text. You will have that problem, you know, how do I get the text of this XSML document? Well, now you have a three-line way of doing it. Just put XSL style sheet, and that's it.
The default rules, are those specifications?
They are. Say it again.
Are they defined in the spec?
Yes, they are defined in the spec. You can assume it. That's right. Yeah, those default rules are defined in the spec. They have. I don't think I have a slide on them anymore, but they tell you what the default rules would be in terms of XSLT and be like, you know, match all elements, match all text nodes, match all attributes, process children. It's a rule that does that. How close are we to the break?
4 minutes.
I think it says quarter after the break. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about applied templates. It's a really important rule. It's kind of the central rule of XSLT, the central kind of instruction. It's kind of magical in the number of things it does. So first is, gets all the child nodes, and we're going to talk in a little bit in a second about how you can actually filter them and only deal with particular types of child nodes, or even how you can get something that's not a child node. But by default, it gets all the child nodes. It's a list of child nodes. Then it finds the rules that apply to each of those child nodes. Then it calls each of those rules with each of the child nodes, one after the other. It takes all the results of those things and it kind of sticks them in where that XSL apply template instruction was, right? So it does quite a bit of work in terms of, it's a looping construct because it gets all the children, but it's a dispatch construct, like a polymorphic method call or something, because it finds the right rule with the right element. The select attribute is an important part of the try templates instruction. It tells the processor which nodes run the nodes that they process. If you want to restrict it to some particular subset. Otherwise, it would just process all of the child nodes. So, here's a simple example. Let's say we want to transform a slideshow in an XML syntax into something like HTML. So it's got an XML vocabulary for slideshows. So here's a slideshow. It has slides elements within it. It has a title element within it. It has two slide elements within it. And each slide has a title. So we have titles at two different levels. That's something we'll have to be careful of. We have multiple points within each slide. And here's what the output looks like. So it's HTML. We're going to want a title. We're going to want an H1 element, which is the same as the title. Anyone who's done any HTML coding should recognize this pattern. You always have to repeat your title because you need it in kind of the metadata title, the browser title, and you need it in the content, right? So we need to repeat that title text, and then we need a horizontal rule, and then we're going to have an H2 for each slide title, and then an unordered list, and then a bunch of list items for each of the points. Okay? So this is what we want to output from that original input. And I strongly encourage you to think through what you want as your output kind of before you start into XSLT in any kind of detail. Otherwise, it can be really kind of frustrating to go through and say, well, that's not exactly what I wanted, but I didn't specify what I wanted, so it's a little bit difficult to debug. So here's how we do this. We'll create a minimal style sheet, just the root elements and so forth.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. and then we'll look at the input document type, and we'll start from the top and handle each of the different elements from the root on down. Usually you work from the top down in XSLT. So here's a minimal style sheet. You're going to do a do-nothing style sheet. You said XSL colon style sheet, the namespace, and the end tag. So let's start first with the template rule for the slideshow itself. So we would have HTML, because we need to output those HTML tags. We put some kind of title, some kind of H1, and then do something with the slides, do something with the body, right? HTML title H1. So here we fill in the blanks now. We're going to, within the first title, we're going to apply templates to the title element from the slide show. Okay, so this select is relative to the current node. So whatever current slideshow element we're dealing with, we're going to find the title sub-element of it. Again, that could be another syntax for that would be dot slash title. In the XPath section, we talked about how dot works. Then we process the same title again. Okay, this is an important point. You're not restricted to handling every element once. You can handle it as many times as you want, including zero. In this case, it's two. So I'm handling each type element twice. And then I'm going to do an apply templates and handle all the slides of elements. Yeah?
Just a quick question. If you were to put that apply, the second apply templates below the apply templates for slides, would it still recognize the title at that level?
Yep.
Even though it travels down the tree and...
Yeah, that's a good question. So XSLT is not a streaming transformation. It doesn't care about what the order of the elements is in the input document. You could, if you wanted to be perverse, output all the elements in backwards order. You could process the slides before the titles and titles before the slideshow. You know, you can process things in whatever order you want. I've been using terminology like database terminology because it's like a database and that everything's accessible, random access in the tree. That's one of the big virtues. It's a downside in terms of performance for XSLT. If you have really large documents, loading them all into memory can really, you know, destroy your performance. But it's a strength in terms of flexibility, simplicity, and especially if you're handling links, any kind of links or references, the fact that you don't have to worry about whether the thing you were referring to came before you or after you is a really important time-saving feature. Everything's available all at once in the input document. On the other hand, the output document is typically generated a little bit at a time. There's nothing that requires an implementation to do that, but they tend to generate the output a little bit at a time. So just to be 100% explicit, if I move this apply templates above the H1, then it will actually process the slide elements before it outputs the H1. The H1 will be the last thing in the document instead of the first. Okay. Now let's do a rule for the title element type. So what we could do is just apply templates whenever we do an element, whenever we see a title element, and it will just output the text of it. But we actually don't have to do this because it's the default rule. It would work without actually putting in this element. Same with slides. Anytime you see a room like this where the only content of it is applied templates, you're not outputting anything at that level, only dealing with its children elements, then you know that you can just take it out. Okay? It's the default rule. Default rule is, as I said, the output text of a node.
Is it legal to have two templates that both have the same XPath for match? And so does it take the first one that it finds?
Well, why do you want to do that?
I'm just okay.
I think what the specification says for Lumally is that it is illegal, but if the processor is going to try to handle it, then it should take the push through. also, there is a feature where you can. If you have two rules that are maybe not identical but similar and they could both match, then that's also illegal. If it only becomes illegal if it ever actually happens. So it doesn't analyze your style sheet in advance and say, whoa, you could have out them here, right? It's not a good type to anything.
With wildcard, it seems like it would be easier to have that happen.
Right. So what would happen is, again, illegal, but if you want to be killed, if you recognize the problem in advance, then you can put a priority, like a number, an attribute on the template, which says, which order to apply them in. Well, which rule is more important than the other one. So it's an arbitrary number. You say priority 100, priority 25, and then 100 would take precedence. You do that rule. If the two of them, conflict, then it'll just do that rule. What you would most often do is try to make the rules kind of specific enough so that they just don't clash, so that you don't need the priority.
I'm a little confused about something. Can you back up one slide?
Sure.
I guess it's two seconds.
Okay.
Okay, you have the apply template, select equals type.
Right.
Right there. Now you, in your input, you have three title elements. Slideshow title and slide title. Wouldn't it return all of those?
No, because this is the same as ./title, which means children of the current title. As the current node, and the current node is slideshow. Okay. To get them all, I would have to do ./title.
It's not
true. Yeah. Or slash title, right?
Okay. Slash title would give me the title of the...
That would expect
the topmost element to be a title. Slash title would expect the topmost element to be a title.
So that's the difference between select and match, because the match people saw previously would have found all the elements.
Yeah. So matches are kind of free floating by default, and selects are rooted in the current context mode. Okay. So I want to emphasize again, whenever you see a rule that's just, that says it's body apply templates, that's the default rule. You can just delete that rule and simplify your stuff. Okay, so look at this slide element rule. Close on a rule, H2 element. We're selecting title. Gets back to the question that we had before. In this case, the title is within the context of the slide. So it only gets the slide title. I do an unordered list. Then apply template to point. So now I'm going to handle all of the point sub elements as well. All make sense, everyone? Here's a point. Essentially, I'm renaming the point element type. Okay. It will process all of the sub elements of the point. So that's it. That's the XSLT style sheet to do that transformation from slideshow to HTML.
What about white space? If you want to turn white space.
You don't ever want to mention white space around XML people. Yeah, white space. You want to kill the white space?
I may sometimes.
Okay, there are a host of different tricks and rules for dealing with white space, unfortunately. I'll give you a summary of them. You can specify the indent on this XSL output element that I've spoken about in passing. You can specify an indent, say that you want elements to be indented. That's one way of dealing with white space. You can, in your XML, you can use the XML space element. This, in the original XML, said that you want to throw away space kind of by default. And XSLT will respect that. You can tell XSLT that these are a list of elements that you should strip white space from when you see them on input. Or these are listed elements, which tell it by default strip white space, but for these particular set of elements, please preserve the white space. Okay. In your style sheet, you can, let me just think for a second. So if you specifically wanted to insert white space in the style sheet, then there's a thing called an XSL colon text element, which exists primarily to allow you to insert white space. And you can make an XSL colon text and put a new line in it, and it'll output its text node that consists only of a new line. If you can avoid worrying about white space, you should. You can see it's kind of a rat hole in both XML and XSL. So I think that's a good place to break with the break. In your notes, I wrote out the final style sheet with everything. You can just type that in if you want to accept it or something.
How come there's no number 3?
Yeah, well, I'm using it to record right now. So.
1, 2, and 4.
That's an excellent question. Is there actually anything? I'll check during the break whether there's actually anything missing.
Really nice, Chris. It works if you, connect it to an external mic, or if you connect it to a line
this
in.
This is a style. This is.
But just so I have it piping in.
How you would actually
encoding it to MP3 right now.
And whatever XSL keyboard says you're using, this is an older one, an example one. Typically, just tell it. Here's my input XML, here's my input XSL, input out.
XSL was in current's a little tight.
Right, the exact syntax will build it, this is the basic model. You give it the two things that are input and tell it where you want it to put your output. And